half-dozen one-arm pull-ups on his office door. He can glance at a magazine cover or a movie trailer and instantly spot who's juiced. Sadly, more of those famous bodies are syringe-pumped than you'd think. But then again, was anyone really surprised when Sylvester Stallone was caught in Australia with nearly 50 vials of human growth hormone in his baggage? Even kids' toys and comic books were infected. Action figures soon became as artificially over-muscled as the Italian stallion. Take Star Wars. Do you remember spotting any tank-tread abs or veiny biceps among the Rebel Alliance? Luke Skywalker and Han Solo barely take off their shirts in the films, and when they do, they're amazingly average. Just a couple of skinny guys who get by on dexterity, not Dianabol. But over the past 30 years, their plastic doppelgangers have gotten crazy huge. Same with G.I. Joe and Batman. Their toy biceps have nearly tripled in size. Our grandfathers were rarely, if ever, exposed to the super male images, Hope notes. They didn't do bench presses or abdominal exercises 3 days a week. Their grandkids, however, are caught in an endless self-image onslaught. A young man is subjected to thousands and thousands of these super male images, Hope complains. Each image links appearance to success, social, financial, and sexual. But these images have steadily grown leaner and more muscular, and thus more and more remote from what any ordinary man can actually attain. The payoff from all those gym reps is supposed to be a Hollywood bod. But once you discover that the road from Rambo 1 to Rambo 2 is paved with injectables, you face the same deflating choice pro cyclists had when they sniffed out Lance Armstrong's secret. Go dirty or go home. There is a fairly sharp limit to the degree of muscularity that a man can attain without drugs, Pope explains. Most boys and men who exceed this limit and who claim they did so without drugs are lying. Before the rise of the machines and the dawn of the super males, he went to the gym to become an athlete. Teddy Roosevelt focused on performance, not appearance, and it made him an athlete for life. Like all self-made men, he was afraid of backsliding, so even after he became president, Roosevelt stuck with what he learned at Woods. He boxed with soldiers, swam naked late at night in the Potomac, and squared off with his buddy, an army general, for bruising battles with wooden cudgels. Some evenings, Roosevelt would slip out of the White House, pick a spot miles in the distance, and head straight for it. The challenge was to reach the goal no matter what obstacles were in the way. On several occasions, we thus swam Rock Creek in the early spring when the ice was floating thick upon it. If we swam the Potomac, we usually took off our clothes. Roosevelt would recall, we liked Rock Creek for these walks because we could do so much scrambling and climbing along the cliffs. Of course, under such circumstances, we had to arrange that our return to Washington should be when it was dark, so that our appearance might scandalize no one. Decades later, Roosevelt's midnight rambles inspired one of the strangest fads of the Kennedy administration. After becoming president, John F. Kennedy was appalled to discover that half the young men called up for the draft were rejected as unfit. Americans were becoming dangerously soft and therefore, in Kennedy's eyes, stupid. Intelligence and skill can only function at the peak of their capacity when the body is healthy and strong, Kennedy declared. In this sense, physical fitness is the basis of all the activities of our society. JFK was interested in true fitness, not bench presses or beach muscle. So he zeroed in on the two factors that matter most, endurance and elastic strength. Thus began America's weird, brief love affair with ultra distance. JFK found an old order from Teddy Roosevelt that required U.S. Marines to hike 50 miles or ride 100 in less than 72 hours. Teddy, naturally, led the way by doing the ride himself during a winter rainstorm. Some of Teddy's troops finished the hike in a single day. So JFK made that his challenge. Could modern Marines cover 50 miles of wild terrain in 24 hours? But before the military could give the command, civilians, including Kennedy's own kid brother, beat them to it. At 5 a.m. one freezing Sunday in February, Bobby Kennedy set off with four Justice Department aides to hike the CNO towpath from D.C. to Harper's Ferry. All four aides dropped out, but by midnight, Bobby had hiked 50 miles in less than 18 hours. The race was on. College frats, Boy Scout troops, high school classes, postmen and policemen, pretty secretaries and beautiful girls, as U.S. News and World Report put it, all tackled the Kennedy Challenge. Congressional staffers marched off in mobs, and a pub in Massachusetts offered free beer at the finish of its own 50-miler. "The 50-mile hike verges on insanity," warned the National Recreation Association, and the doom prediction was seconded by the American Medical Association. "We get distress when people go out and strain themselves." News photographers fanned out to capture the carnage, and instead found the same expression on faces across the country. Grins of pride. People who'd never moved their legs for more than an hour at a stretch were thrilled to discover that just by heading out the door, they could keep on going. Speed records tumbled. Bobby Kennedy was beaten by a high school girl in California who was edged out by a 50-year-old postman in New Jersey who was bested by a Marine who smoked it home in under 10 hours. Kennedy's murder brought the armies of challengers to a halt, except in one small town in Maryland, where the same shock of personal discovery has been playing out every year since 1963. Only four people finished the first race, seven the next, 18 after that. But while all the other Kennedy challengers died away, Boonesboro kept getting stronger. It's a tough race. The JFK 50 sends you up the steep and rocky Appalachian Trail and then down long switchbacks to the CNO towpath to follow in Bobby Kennedy's footsteps. A half century later, Boonesboro is still holding fast to Kennedy's vision. Now, nearly 1,000 entrants set off on the Saturday before Thanksgiving to discover for themselves what Kennedy suspected from the beginning. If we have the confidence to start, we'll find what we need to finish. The JFK 50 is no longer the country's longest race, and it's never been the sexiest. Big city marathons have rock bands and movie stars. Tough mudders have Arctic enema ice water plunges and mud scrambles and electric shock hazards, while the JFK has silence. For long, lonely stretches, it's just you and your doubts. No cheering, no glimpses of Pamela Anderson and Will Ferrell, no victory lap through Central Park. But like one of those old family diners dwarfed by new skyrises, JFK survives for a reason. It's where soldiers and Marines are honored as elites. And a 13-year-old girl who's told she's too young for the New York City Marathon can run a double through the mountains instead. It's where Zach Miller, an unknown cruise ship worker who trains on a treadmill at sea, could shock even himself in 2012 by uncorking one of the greatest performances in the race's history. The JFK could have been designed by Teddy Roosevelt and Georges Hébert. It's the kind of enduring testament to the spirit of natural movement, to proficiency and purpose, that you rarely find anymore. Unless, of course, you're in Brazil. Down here, another route to excellence has been dusted off from the past. It's been lost for so long, it now sounds exotic and oddly stirring. And one of the few who still know how it's done, how to be fit to be useful, has just jumped out my window and is waiting impatiently below to lead me into the jungle. Chapter 28. The athlete that you remember is the beautiful dancing athlete, Edward Villalla. undefeated welterweight boxer and lead dancer in the New York City Ballet. Erwan LeCour and I are staying in a small cabana hotel in the woods, built by a French hippie couple who came to Itacare 20 years ago to explore the jungle and never left. From behind the cabanas, a smooth dirt trail wanders over the forested hills and down to the beach, about 3 miles away. As much for his mind as for his body, Erwan likes to run it barefoot. Awareness of the world begins with your feet, he believes. Do you know why you get stressed after staring at your computer for a half hour? Erwan asks after I join him outside. Because humans evolve to always be aware of threats around them. That stress you feel building up is your body's reminder to get up and take a look at the landscape. Same with your feet. If you're not letting them do their job and tell your back and knees when they can relax, then your body stays stiff, giving you knee problems and backaches. Your bare feet can sense when you're balanced and on solid terrain, in other words, so they can signal to the rest of your body that it's safe and can loosen up a little. We set off at an easy jog, winding through the trees until we emerge on a serene half moon of beach, just as the first slants of morning sun slash across the waves. We have it all to ourselves, until a gang of men emerges from the trees behind us. Mais uma vichema, shouts a tattooed bruiser who looks like he just escaped a prison yard. Another victim. Erwan glances around. He spots a bowling ball-sized rock on the sand. With a quick crouch, he scoops it up and snaps it with a sharp, two-handed throw straight at the bruiser's chest. Instead of diving out of the way, the guy catches the rock like it was a basketball, tosses it aside, and comes right at Erwan, raising his fist and growling like a grizzly. They lock arms around each other's necks, then break apart, grinning. He's no victim, Erwan says in Portuguese, jerking his head toward me. He's a work in progress, like you. Erwan introduces me to his buddy, Sergino, a burly jiu-jitsu instructor who moonlights as a spear fisherman. The other 7 guys are stripping off shirts and kicking off flip-flops, ready to get down to business. Erwan wandered here from his home near Paris more than a year ago, and quickly realized Itacare had all the natural training apparatus that Georges Herbert would have loved, plus the perfect band of collaborators, a small community of Brazilian fighters who support themselves by moonlighting as surfing instructors and spearfishing guides. It's an ideal alliance. The fighters help sharpen Erwan's grappling and swimming skills, while Erwan dreams up new ways to frustrate the hell out of them. Zucchetto can attest to that. Zucchetto is a 2-time jiu-jitsu world champion and a free diver who once killed a shark using only a scuba knife and a lungful of air. But the afternoon before, Zucchetto had met his match. Erwan had lashed a long bamboo pole between 2 trees, forming a bouncy balance beam about 8 feet long and as high as my head. Erwan swung himself up, then beckoned Zucchetto to join him. What are you waiting for? Erwan taunted. Zucchetto grabbed the pole with 2 meaty fists, muscled himself up like a swimmer getting out of a pool, and lost his balance and fell back to the ground. He leaped again and again, while Erwan amused himself by hopping from foot to foot. When Zucchetto finally stepped back, his chest heaving in fatigue and frustration, Erwan hopped down. He grabbed Zucchetto by both shoulders and gave him a friendly, tousling shake. This guy is in amazing shape, Erwan said. He's strong and has great endurance. But what happened here? All he had to do was get on top of this pole, and he couldn't. I can do it. Zucchetto's great-grandfather could probably do it. At one point in time, just about every man alive could do it. But Zucchetto can't. And why? Because his body isn't smart enough. A smart body Erwin explains, knows how to convert force and speed into an almost endless menu of practical movements. Hoisting yourself atop a pole may seem trivial, but if you're ever caught in a flood or fleeing an attacking dog, elevating your body 5 feet off the ground can make all the difference. I meet men all the time who can bench 400 pounds, but can't climb up through a window to get someone out of a burning building, he continued. I know guys who can run marathons, but can't sprint to anyone's rescue until they put their shoes on first. Lots of swimmers do laps every morning, but can't dive deep enough to save a friend, or know how to carry him over rocks to get him out of the surf. Erwan was talking with his back to the pole. Without warning, he pivoted and launched himself into the air. He caught the pole on the fly, arched under it to gain momentum, and then, just before his mount, he slowed enough for us to follow his moves. He twisted his hips and knees, rising like a surfer catching a wave. He hopped down, light as a cat, and mounted the pole 2, 3, 6 more times, using his elbows, ankles, shoulders, and neck to create new climbing combinations. Being fit isn't about being able to lift a steel bar or finish an Ironman, Erwan said. It's about rediscovering our biological nature and releasing the wild human animal inside. He stepped back so Suketto could try again and grinned with satisfaction as Suketto maneuvered himself up and found his balance, pumping his fist in the air like he'd won his third world championship. This is what I came to find, the natural method in its natural habitat. Georges Hébert had made some pretty powerful promises about what it could do, and if he was right, it might just explain how Paddy and the other Brits on Crete accomplished something that most of the other dirty tricksters couldn't, seeing their next birthday. In the operation's first year alone, more than half of Chan and Paddy's fellow members of the Special Operations Executive on the continent were killed, captured, or otherwise eliminated. One SOE agent was assigned to infiltrate the Riviera's casinos, but mysteriously vanished, along with a briefcase full of cash, before he could lay a bet. In Holland, an SOE radio man was captured by the Gestapo and forced at gunpoint to send messages that lured other agents to their death. In Austria, one of the SOE's top men, Alfgar Hesketh Pritchard, the best mathematical brain of his age in England, and son of a legendary army sniper, hiked into the mountains and never hiked out. "This is no place for a gentleman," he messaged before disappearing. In France, Gus March Phillips revealed a spectacular talent for sneaking up on solitary German soldiers and hauling them back to Britain as prisoners. "There comes out of the sea from time to time a hand of steel which plucks the German sentries from their post with growing efficiency," Churchill raved in a radio broadcast, but said nothing when, soon after, the hand of steel met a blaze of bullets. Yet on Crete, a man trapped prowled by subs and crawling with enemy troops and informants, British undercover ops hadn't lost a single man since John Pendlebury was killed during the invasion. You can't chalk it up to their training, woeful as it was, or their raw ability. With their taste for sword sticks and poetry, with their tendency to describe German harbour mines as about the size of a Jeroboam of champagne, the Cretan crew seemed more at home with cocktails than combat. At best, they had, as Anthony Beaver put it, a rather dashing and eccentric amateurism, what might be expected from a mixture of romantics and archaeologists. But once on the sliver, they didn't just learn, they learned fast. Georges Hébert knew the reason, though maybe not the modern term. It's likely they were aided by biophilia, or rewilding the psyche. We're all familiar with the way the human body evolved, the way our backs straightened and our limbs lengthened as our ancestors left the trees and adapted to life on the ground as long-range hunter-gatherers. But natural selection didn't just affect the way we look. It also shaped the way we think. We are living proof that our ancestors, those puny, furless, fangless wimps, developed a superb ability to read the trees, air, and ground. They lived or died by the element of surprise, which meant they had to detect danger before danger detected them, and track their prey by interpreting the faintest scents, scuffs, and rustles. That's why we're still attracted to what eco-psychologists call the soft fascinations of the natural world. Moonlight, autumnal forests, whispering meadows, and aren't too surprised when we hear that certain prime ministers and ex-presidents feel the compulsion to paint, over and over, mountain ranges and grazing horses. Winston Churchill began painting during World War I, and relied on it the rest of his life to keep the black dog of depression at bay, while George W. Bush picked up the brushes immediately after his two-war presidency, and has been turning out a stream of landscapes and kitten and puppy portraits ever since. Because nature is so soothing, right? So relaxing. No. Because it's Red Bull for the brain. Or so University of Michigan researchers found when they ran a series of tests in 2008, pitting, essentially, your brain in the woods versus your brain on asphalt. Student volunteers were given a series of numbers and asked to recite them in reverse order. Then they were split up and sent on a roughly one-hour walk. Half of the volunteers strolled Huron Street in downtown Ann Arbor, while the other half meandered the Arboretum. When they got back to the lab, they were tested again. This time, Arboretum crew didn't just outscore the streetwalkers, they outscored themselves. Performance on backwards digit span significantly improved when participants walked in nature, but not when they walked downtown, the researchers found. In addition, these results were not driven by changes in mood, nor were they affected by different weather conditions. But maybe it was a matter of noise. Maybe the city walkers were temporarily frazzled from all that traffic clatter. So the researchers came up with a new experiment. And that's when things got really interesting. Volunteers were given the same test, but instead of going for a walk afterward, they were shown pictures of either urban or woodland scenes. Then they were retested. Once again, city lost to nature. And not just to nature, but fake nature. So if you think sunsets and seacoasts are just pretty views, the researchers concluded, you're making a big mistake. Simple and brief interactions with nature can produce marked increases in cognitive control. They explain in a paper for Psychological Science called The Cognitive Benefits of Interacting with Nature. Treating that oceanfront hotel room as merely an amenity, they add, fails to recognize the vital importance of nature in effective cognitive functioning. That's all it takes. Just a reminder of our ancestral past can be enough to flip a switch in the brain that focuses attention and shuts out distractions. You slip back into hunter-gatherer mode, and when you do, you're capable of remarkable things. You can close your eyes and track by nose like a bloodhound, and even ride a mountain bike down a trail blindfolded, and never miss a turn or hit a tree. Journalist Michael Finkel learned about human echolocation, the ability to see by sound, like bats, when he met Daniel Kish, a blind adventurer. Kish had his eyeballs removed when he was 1 year old because of a degenerative disease, but he grew up to become a skilled cyclist and solo backcountry hiker by relying on the echoes from sound waves he creates by clicking his tongue. He is so accomplished at echolocation that he's able to pedal his mountain bike through streets heavy with traffic and on precipitous dirt trails, Finkel reports. He climbs trees. He camps out by himself, deep in the wilderness. He's lived for weeks at a time in a tiny cabin, a 2 mile hike from the nearest road. He travels around the globe. He's a skilled cook, an avid swimmer, a fluid dance partner. Kish says his hearing isn't special, just his listening. As proof, he holds up a pot lid. When Finkel closes his eyes and clucks, He's surprised to find he can instantly detect the difference when Kish moves the lid closer and farther from his face. You've actually got more raw ability to echolocate than a bat. Our mouths aren't as suited for squeaking, but we've got a big advantage when it comes to interpreting echoes. Just the auditory cortex of a human brain is many times larger than the entire brain of a bat, Finkel points out. This means that humans can likely process more complex auditory information than bats. For years, Kish has been teaching other blind students how to move in real-life ways. He sent two of them off to mountain bike with Finkel in California's Santa Ana Mountains. To determine where the trail is going, and where the bushes and rocks and fence posts and trees are, the boys rely on echolocation, Finkel notes. The riders slap their tongues against the bottom of their mouths, listen for the echoes, and form a mental image of the trail ahead, all at full speed. One flies down the dirt trail in aerodynamic form, hands off the brakes, clicking as fast and as loud as he can, an awestruck Finkel finds. I try and warn them when the trail presents a serious consequence, like a long drop-off on one side or a cactus jutting out. But mostly I'm just along for the ride. It's difficult to believe, even though it's happening right in front of me. It's incredible. The only crash, in fact, is Finkel's fault when he hits the brakes in front of one of the blind riders and turns himself into an instant tree. Your nose, which can detect more than a trillion distinct odors, has as much untapped ancestral power as your ears. A research team at the University of California, Berkeley, was curious to see whether humans can mimic bloodhounds and track by scent. So they blindfolded 32 student volunteers and had them put on earmuffs, thick gloves, and knee pads to eliminate any sensory input, except smell. Then they laid out a 30-foot trail of chocolate essence in a grassy field and turned them loose. 2/3 of the subjects successfully followed the scent, zigzagging back and forth across the path like a dog tracking a pheasant, the researchers reported in Nature Neuroscience. With zero training, most of them did well. With a little practice, they were great. Their tracking speed more than doubled after a few days, and that was just the tip of their potential. Longer-term training would lead to further increases in tracking velocity, the researchers noted. Yale University neuroscientist Dr. Gordon Shepherd had the money quote when he learned of the experiment. If we go back on our four legs and get down on the ground, we may be able to do things we had no idea we could do. Seeing in the dark, tracking prey by nose. Today they sound like superpowers, but for 2 million years, they were just survival. We haven't lost the natural strengths that made us the most formidable creatures on the planet. We might just need the natural method to wake them up. On Itakare's beach that morning, Erwan Lecour hoists a rock about the size of a watermelon and passes it to Sergino, who pivots and hands it to me. I swing it into the hands of the guy beside me as Erwan hands Sergino another rock, then another, until there are 5 in play, and it's all I can do to get one rock out of my hands before the next is shoved into my gut. Unlike medicine balls, which always have the same easily graspable shape, the unpredictable size and weight of rocks forces you to focus intensely on grip and balance. Even though the rocks are slickening with sweat and my arms are burning, I'm desperate not to be the first to let one slip. Luckily, just when I'm in danger of smashing my toes, Erwan raises a hand for us to stop. I drop my rock, relieved, until I find out what's up next. He pairs us off for Erwan-style wind sprints. Each of us has to hoist another guy across our shoulders in a rescue hold and race in and out of the knee-high surf. If there's a more nerve-wracking workout than preventing a 220-pound Thai fighter from falling on your head while you're sprinting through churning water, I don't want to know about it. Humans are heavy and lumpy and oddly balanced, forcing you to constantly adjust your posture, footing, handholds, and core. Keeping control of a body on your back, as I soon learn, demands intense concentration. Next, Air One has a pile of 6-foot-long driftwood poles at the ready. The other guys know what to expect and start trotting down the beach. As they pass Air One, he tosses some of them a pole. He tosses the last one to me, then takes off on a run with his hands outstretched. I toss it back, and he immediately flips it toward me again, this time a little ahead, so I have to accelerate. We cross the entire beach this way, mixing up our throws, totally absorbed in our run and gun, until I notice we're about to crash into the rocks. Without breaking stride, Erwin flips the stick around, plants it in the sand, and pole vaults up onto the boulders. By the time I climb up after him, he's 20 yards away, scuttling to the top of a giant rock overhanging the sand.
"The secret to a good jump," he says, "is a good second jump. Remember your springs."
And with that, he's sailing through the air. He lands 10 feet below with a deep knee bend, but instead of rolling or dropping to his knees, he bounces right up with a hop and tears off at a sprint.
"You never see an animal stick a jump by flopping all over the ground," he calls up as he loops back around. "Cats are running the second they land. If you do it the same way, you'll decrease impact and be ready to flow into your next move."
All that empty air below makes Zucchetto pause.
"Caraglio, esse giaggio è forte," Zucchetto mutters.
"Damn, that guy is strong." Then he surrenders to trust and sails off over the rocks. For Air One, finding Itacaré was lucky, but no accident. He'd grown up in Étréchy, an old-worldish city in northern France that's only 25 miles from Paris, but still surrounded by tumbling rivers and old-growth forest. Air One's father worked in a bank during the week and loved to plunge into the woods on the weekends, taking his son on long, rambling hikes.
"He would climb a boulder that was too hard for me," Air One recalls. "I'd ask him for help. He'd just shake his head and go like this."
Air One lets his face go stony and crooks a beckoning finger. Any soccer coach would have drooled over this tall, fearless, cat-quick kid, but those woodsy weekend boot camps with his silent father squelched any interest Air One might have had in team sports. Instead, he went the solitary route. First martial arts, earning his karate black belt by the time he was 18, then Olympic-style weightlifting, then triathlons. Oddly, the better he did, the worse he felt. He worried constantly that he wasn't training hard enough and became enraged whenever he lost in competition. Air One was still a teenager, but already his fun was making him miserable. He needed a way out, and the Werewolf of Paris just might have it. For some time, Air One had been hearing rumors about a mysterious inner-city savage who roamed the rooftops at night and called himself Hors Humain, beyond human. Air One asked around and eventually was led to Don Jean Ebrey, the Fagin of a secret gang of young men who turned the city into their own wilderness park. Don Jean was pushing 40 at the time, but Air One couldn't tell by his fight-ready physique and mane of thick black hair, held back by a sensei's headband. Soon, Air One was part of the tribe, learning a kind of urban guerrilla training that Don Jean called combat vital.
"It was like a fight club of natural movement," Air One explained. "We would train most of the time at night so as not to be seen, climbing bridges, balancing on the top of scaffoldings, kicking walls to toughen our bare feet, moving on all fours, dropping off bridges into the Seine in the freezing cold of winter."
Combat vital was equal parts hardcore conditioning and high-wire performance art, both without a net. Don Jean's gang would hang by their legs from a pedestrian overpass and do upside-down crunches over speeding traffic, and climb to the top of apartment buildings to leap barefoot from roof to roof.
There is no try for this kind of practice, Erwan says. If you miss, you die.
But Don Juan seemed unkillable. Over time, he graduated from secret midnight stunts into full-on spectacles, leaping from a helicopter in nothing but a bathing suit to swim around an iceberg off Greenland, and, at age 60, serenading the Loch Ness Monster with a one-man kettle drum sonata before free-diving into the freezing lake to look for it. For 7 years, Erwan roamed Paris and dodged police by night with Don Juan and the Combat Vital crew. He spent his summers working the beaches of Corsica, selling toys and junk jewelry and stick-on tattoos to sunbathing tourists, eventually figuring out a way to become his own middleman. He designed his own plastic refrigerator magnets and found a factory in Shanghai to manufacture them. Soon he was earning enough in royalties to live on the rest of the year. As Don Juan drifted toward showmanship, his student got serious about scholarship. Erwan's eyes first opened to Combat Vital's roots when he was prowling the second-hand bookstalls along the Seine and happened across an old copy of Georges Hébert's L'Education Physique. He'd vaguely heard of it. There was talk among the Combat Vital disciples that Don Juan, and even the Yamakaze creators of parkour, had gotten some of their ideas from Hébert. Erwan dug in and was electrified. Be useful. Genius. It wasn't just a motto, Erwan realized. It was a law of nature, a first principle that explains how human history formed the human body. Suddenly it made sense. We're weird-looking for a reason. Strip us naked and humans look more like insects than animals. What with our spindly legs and gangly arms and fat, round heads swiveling on top of peculiarly inflexible spines. We're slow and weak and can barely climb to save our lives. And we lack all the really good stuff like tails and hooves and fangs. We'd be helpless if we couldn't do three things. Hunt, gather, and share. Period. That's it. Those three occupations have been the human career path since the dawn of time, and we're still at it today. Shakespearean sonnets, Google, the Super Bowl, NASA, strip all human achievement down to basics, and they're essentially the same thing. We look for stuff, we hit it with a rock, we share the goodies and the info with the clan. We're far from the baddest cats in the jungle, but we don't have to be. For those three jobs, our bodies are the perfect tool. We can stand tall and pivot, allowing us to throw with deadly accuracy. We've got multi-jointed arms and awesome thumbs, ideal for gripping and toting. We've got language and literature because our necks are long, our lips are nimble, and our thoracic control is off the charts, all of it combining to allow the power of speech. We're Mother Nature's problem child, the species that can't sit still, because our upright posture and rubbery legs give us fantastic running range. We are what we do, and what we do is move. Up mountains, across rivers, through the snakiest rock-face wormholes. We can't even stay put on our own planet. Hébert didn't invent this stuff, Erwan knew. Well before witnessing the Martinique volcano, Hébert had been intrigued by the ocean-going gymnastics of the gabiers, deckhands who wrestled sailcloth and scaled masts and wet rigging in wind and surging seas.
Those guys must have been really impressive and great athletes, Erwan thought.
Hébert also spent time in French colonies and found his ideal athletes in Montagnard mountain tribesmen in Vietnam and African hunter-gatherers.
Their bodies were splendid, flexible, nimble, skillful, enduring, resistant, and yet they had no other tutor in gymnastics but their lives in nature, Hébert observed.
Hébert wasn't an inventor. He was an observer. That's what made him so fiery about things like female strength, because he knew the truth was right under the nose of anyone willing to open their eyes and minds. Young black African woman, where the magnificent development of the torso stands comparison with Venus, Hébert argued. What a marvelous idea for the French mother. Renoir's paintings of bathing beauties drove Hébert nuts. Why pretend women are nothing more than animated cream puffs? Men and women don't have the same bodies, but they have the same motor skills. The natural doctrine applies as much to girls' education as it does to boys, Hébert insisted. Wait, put gender aside for a sec. What about age? If Hébert was right, Erwan thought, he wasn't just promoting good health, he was freezing time. How did Hébert put it? Their bodies were resistant. Exactly. There's no margin for error in the wilderness, so our survival depended on long-lasting suppleness and sinew. When that volcano blows, when the clan needs your help, when the moment comes to move, you can't be icing a sore knee on the sofa or excusing yourself as too old, young, or girly. Méthode naturelle could make you not only powerful, Erwin realized, but also age-resistant. You'd get strong and stay strong, deep into old age. Erwin was on fire. He went on a research pilgrimage to Reims, site of Georges Hébert's first training playground, which was destroyed during frontline fighting in World War I. The Marquis Melchior de Polignac, owner of Champagne Pommerie, was a big fan of Hébert's work, so he made sure it was later restored to Hébert's original specifications. While Erwan was in Reims, he knocked up at Pommerie headquarters to see if maybe they had some old Georges Hébert stuff lying around. Journals, possibly, or photos. They had something even better. A phone number. In the suburbs of Paris, Hébert's son was still alive. Régis Hébert agreed to let this intense young disciple visit, and keep on visiting. Every time Erwan returned to the Hébert house, he was hungrier than before. I came back with a big list of questions, questions I couldn't find any answer to in Hébert's book, about Hébert, his personal lifestyle, how he educated his children. Régis said his father had lived what he preached, including the revolutionary step of deploying his wife and other women as méthode naturelle instructors. Just before the war began, Georges felt he was close to connecting true health with heroism. It was the great time of MN, Erwin says. Hébert believed that if everyone was practicing MN with its altruistic goal, with its moral education benefits, there would be no wars anymore, no reasons for people to be in conflict with each other. Hébert didn't live to see his dream come true, but Erwan could. Someone had to remind the world what méthode naturelle had to offer. Erwan went to get Régis's blessing, and the old man erupted. How dare Erwan think he could follow in the great man's footsteps? If Erwan tried, Régis warned him, he'd regret it. Erwan was stung and mystified. What the hell just happened? A few weeks earlier, Régis had been all smiles and encouragement. Now he was sputtering and threatening. Erwan couldn't figure out what went wrong until he tracked down some other MN old-timers who wised him up. Hébert's son is the gravedigger of his father's work, they told Erwan. Régis can't revive méthode naturelle himself, but is afraid someone else will, they said. So he just clutches his father's legacy to his chest and monitors anything said or written about it like some kind of censor. So the old man never really wanted to meet me in the first place, Erwan thought. He just wanted to find out what I was up to. Okay, Erwan decided. So that's how we'll play. Erwan knew Georges Hébert had sucked up information from all over, not just from native islanders, but also from thinkers like Edwin Checkley, Dr. Paul Carton, the pioneering French physician, Francisco Amorós, the Spanish military instructor, and Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi, the Swiss education innovator. From their ideas, Hébert fashioned his own. Did Hébert just replicate the path Emeros had designed? Erwan asks.
Nope. He followed it but retooled it, improved it, redesigned it.
So to hell with Regis. Now it was Erwan's turn.
Sergino and the guys have to scoot, and only then does it hit me that we've been working out non-stop for nearly 2 hours. I'm wiped out, but exhilarated. Erwan suggests we cool off by practicing one more skill, open water deep dives. But before we reach the surf, we're approached by a young woman who'd been watching from under a coconut tree.
So, she asks, what's with all the rock jumping and stick throwing?
Instead of explaining, Erwan grabs a driftwood pole. He plants one end in the sand and rests the other on his shoulder. He bends into a squat.
What's your name? He asks.
Sandra.
Sandra, if you can get to the top of this pole, I have a surprise for you.
Sandra studies his face for hints of a prank.
Then she sprints, straight up the pole and over the top of Erwan's head.
She's on the ground before she realizes she really did it.
Bravo!
Erwan says, delighted. Then he removes the pole from his shoulder and places it on hers.
Surprise!
Erwan barely gives her a chance to protest before he's off, quick-footing up the pole like a tightrope walker. Sandra's face flashes through 4 emotional peaks in 4 seconds. Surprise, fear, resolve, and, as Erwan reaches her shoulder and hops off, triumph.
Did you know you were that strong?
Erwan asks. Sandra shakes her head.
Now you do. Don't get into trouble.
Sandra smiles and starts to head back to her tree, but Erwan has another question.
Are you doing yoga?
Uh-oh.
Yes, I'm an instructor, and...
You teach that?
Erwan says. Have you ever used yoga for anything useful?
It's very useful. No, in real life, in an emergency. Has anyone ever shouted, quick, sun salute for your life?
Of course not. But you hear, run for your life, climb for your life. Don't worry, I'll carry you out of here, all the time.
Humans made yoga up for recreation, not for survival. No animal would ever do it. Changing postures in the same place with your head down? Forget it. In the wild, that's death. You need the luxury of a no-danger environment for yoga. Everything is controlled. The soft mat, the temperature, some guru telling you what to do. It's not instinctive or natural. It's make-believe.
Yoga isn't about emergencies, Sandra argues. It's about finding balance and a mind-body connection.
Your body will never be more connected to your mind than when something is at stake,
Erwan retorts.
That's how you measure the value of a movement, by its consequences. Climb a tree, throw a rock, balance on the edge of a cliff. You lose focus for a fraction of a second, you're screwed. It takes a very affluent and indulged culture to convince itself that standing around in weird poses is exercise.
Despite Erwan's rat-a-tat attack, it's obvious he wants to win Sandra over, not beat her down. That's enough to make her step once more into the buzzsaw.
You're forgetting flexibility, she offers. Yoga makes you more limber.
If your muscles resist a movement, it's because the movement is unnatural. So why change the muscle? Change the movement.
Erwan drops down in the sand and juts a leg out in a hurdler's pose.
If your hamstring won't let you stretch like this, he says, bending forward with his head over his knee, then move like this.
Swiftly, he jackknifes the leg back so it folds under his butt. He's able to reach much farther forward, and he's much better balanced.
Now, which one is a real mind-body connection?
I think he's really onto something, says Lee Saxby, a physical therapist and technical director of Wild Fitness, a London-based exercise program built around an evolutionary model of human performance. Saxby is convinced that true human health has nothing to do with exercise machines
and everything to do with hunter-gatherer movements. And when he stumbled across a remarkable video by Erwan, he found Exhibit A in the flesh. As declarations of war go, it's unique. In a magical 3.5 minutes called The Workout the World Forgot, Erwan makes a devastating case for ancestral fitness, and he does it without saying a single word. It opens with Erwan carrying a log across a tumbling river, then rockets along as he charges across a savage landscape, instantly molding his body under and around everything in his path. He sprints straight at a stone tower, crashing waves, a breathtakingly high ledge, a mixed martial arts fighter who appears out of nowhere. And Erwan never slows, instead twisting, sprinting, swimming, climbing, fighting, and vaulting past them all. He's utterly serene and terribly powerful, a human animal in command of his body and everything it meets. What impresses me most about that video is his athleticism, Saxby says. It drives me crazy that women think being in shape is being skinny and men think it's being big. But the best athletes don't look like models or bodybuilders. They're lean and quick and mobile. That's what I like about Erwan's video. It's a demonstration of real functional fitness, the opposite of the bulking up stuff they teach you in the gym. Erwan, in fact, could be one of the best living examples of what our bodies were originally designed to do. Versatility was absolutely the key to survival, because early humans had to be ready for anything at any time, explains E. Paul Zehr, PhD, a neuroscience and kinesiology professor at the University of Victoria, who examined human biomechanical potential in his book, Becoming Batman, The Possibility of a Superhero. When early Homo sapiens set off in the morning, he never knew what he'd encounter. If your daily life is hunting and being hunted, at a moment's notice you might have to sprint, jog, throw a spear, scramble up a tree, hunker down and dig. The specialization we enjoy today, be it as a marathoner, tennis player, even a triathlete, is a luxury of modern society. It doesn't have great survival value for Homo sapiens in the wild. But Erwan's most important throwback could be the way he's welded purpose and playfulness, function and fun. When he jumps and tumbles and chucks stuff around, he looks just like a kid goofing around in the backyard, which Dr. Zehr believes could be our true ancestral workout. You never see your dog running non-stop around and around in a circle for an hour, Zehr points out. If he did, you'd think there's something really wrong with him. Instead, he'll chase something, roll around, sprint, rest, mix things up. Animal play has a purpose, and it's not hard to surmise that human play should as well. Most people see exercise as punishment for being fat, adds Saxby. So instead of being a release for stress, it's one more mental burden. That's why I think what this guy Erwan is up to is bang on. If you can reverse the idea that exercise is punishment, that's a great gift. Reverse the idea. Maybe by creating giant adult playgrounds? With mud pits and flaming straw bales and wacky electrical shock hazards that look like jellyfish tentacles? In 2010, one of the least likely voices in fitness, a Harvard Business School student, traveled to the least likely place to launch a trend, Allentown, Pennsylvania, and rigged together some big kid toys on a backwater ski resort. 5 years later, tough mudders and other obstacle course challengers like warrior dashes and Spartan races, are sonic booming. Jogging is even in danger of losing its crown as most popular participation sport, because this year more people are likely to splash through a freezing pond en route to a wall climb than run a half marathon. Granted, these mass muckathons are more about thrills than skills. Few Spartan racers do anything more to prepare for the cargo net scrambles and water tower leaps than paint their faces and pay the fee. Still, there's a good bit about these events that would warm Georges Hébert's heart. Tough Mudder has no winners or finishing times. focusing instead on camaraderie over competition, and all of them at least champion the idea of functional fitness. By the time you finish, you'll know lots about what you can't do. As far as doing it, that's where the box comes in. In the early 2000s, word began to spread among California police officers and local Navy SEALs that the best place to find a real-world workout was the vacant lot behind a FedEx depot in Santa Cruz. There, a former competitive gymnast named Greg Glassman was leading the faithful through sprints, deadlifts, and his holy trinity of functional fitness, squats, pull-ups, and burpees, a push-up that explodes into a hop. Those three maneuvers, getting up off your butt, up off your belly, and up off the ground, are basic for animal survival, yet Glassman found that many people couldn't handle them. And isn't that the whole point of exercise, just mastering your body weight? He called his approach CrossFit, and the cops he trained said it felt less like a conventional workout and more like a foot race that turns into a fight. CrossFit remains so wedded to pure and simple movement that if Teddy Roosevelt were to rise from the dead, the one place he'd feel at home after 96 years would be a CrossFit box, so dubbed because an early training facility was a storage unit in a San Francisco parking lot. But on Crete, there weren't any boxes. For Chan and Paddy to survive, they'd have to rely on something even more urgent and ancestral, something that could prepare them for a fugitive's life in the mountains. Something like what Erwan is getting up to in the branches overhead.
"Ready?" Erwan asks from his perch 20 feet up in a tree.
"Sure you are," he answers himself before we can speak.
"Let's do it."
After 3 days of double sessions training, it's time for my combination going away present final exam. Erwan has fashioned an obstacle course that will both test my jungle man skills and give me a model to reconstruct back home in Pennsylvania. In keeping with his gospel of group dynamics, he asks Suqueto and Fabio, another Brazilian fighter, to join me.
"The test," Erwan says, "is to finish the course twice in less than 20 minutes.
He drops his hand. "Go!" And we're off, chasing hard on each other's heels. Erwan's course has about 12 stations, all of them sequenced into a natural flow through the forest. We're springing up into trees, contorting through the branches, and shinnying down 15-foot poles. He has us hoisting heavy corduroy logs up on an end and flipping them bottom over top up a hill. Then we're crawling around stakes in the ground and snaking on our bellies through an overturned dugout canoe mounted a few inches off the ground. Even a small cabin comes into play. We're vaulting through one window and out the other. The most ingenious thing about Erwan's course, I realize as I finish the first lap, is how universal it is. Sure, it's a blast to horse around in trees in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest, but there isn't anything here that can't be duplicated in a suburban backyard, or even a suburban street, if you're blessed with Erwin's total disregard for arched eyebrows. The day before, I'd watched him stroll down Itacaré's main street and treat it like his personal rec center. He monkey-walked up a staircase on all fours, tightrope-walked along a railing, and vaulted back and forth down the length of a fence. By the time we'd walked 5 blocks, he'd knocked out a healthy workout and was ready for pizza. I have 3 minutes left, and only 2 obstacles to go. A leap from the porch, then a quick climb up a 20-foot pole braced between the ground and a branch high in a tree. I'm trying not to show it, but through the sweat and grime on my face, I'm beaming. 2 days ago, my heart was in my throat before every jump. Now, after just 72 hours, I feel unstoppable. All I need to do is push a little harder, and I'll be right on Fabio's heels. Naturally, that's when disaster strikes. When I stick the landing off the porch, a red-hot knife jabs me in the spine. My back is seizing so badly, I can't even stand up straight. I should have known I was pushing my luck,
14-hour plane trips always leave me tight as a banjo string. So that's it, I'm done. Until I remember Erwan's motto. Smart body, I remind myself. Use your smart body. I take hold of the long pole that extends on a 45-degree angle up into the tree. Gingerly, I hook one foot up, then the other,